This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on June 7th, 2012. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The first item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-17, Red Blue T, LLC. We have with us this morning Mr. Craig Engel and Mr. Brett Kappel. Are they here? You want to come join us? Good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
We discussed this advisory opinion at our last meeting on May 24th, and it was held over for further consideration. And thank you for your supplemental comments. That was very helpful. Mr. Lutz, do you have anything to add?
No, Chair Hunter.
No? Okay. Then we have two drafts before us on this, actually three drafts before us on this advisory opinion. And are there any questions or comments? Are there any questions or comments? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also want to thank the requesters for their continued efforts to help us reach a resolution here and all the information that you provided, which really has been very helpful and very informative. And I just want to clarify something because I think I understand this, but I just want to make sure. It's my understanding that you will be providing, or your client will be providing, to political committees phone numbers along with the donations, right? And it'll be an itemized list, right, by phone number?
That's correct.
Okay. That's what I thought. I don't know if other people have other questions.
Okay. Anybody have any other questions? I think it's Steve.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Commissioner Walter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask a question about some information that came to us in one of the comments from Extreme Payment Processing, and that was the issue of the prepaid telephones and how that works in a given case like this where, as I understand it, that telephone, maybe you can tell me how that works. Does it work any different? Because at that point, it appears that there would be very little chance of really verifying the identity of the contributor, or potentially if somebody were to buy a bunch of crickets or whatever they are nowadays and start making text contributions.
What do you want to do?
Well, two things. Yeah, there is always that possibility. If someone wants to buy a prepaid phone for $200 to make a $50 contribution, I suppose they could do that. But that's true of any anonymous contribution in cash submitted in an envelope. I do not know whether or not the CTAA allows those types of phones, which they can identify. They can identify whether those phones are prepaid phones. I don't know whether they allow short codes to be processed on those phones, or if they could block them. I don't know. We'd have to find that out from the industry.
It did appear, and again, total novice here. We're learning basically from the documents that we're receiving in this matter, and so when you get the information here in Extreme Payment Processing, it was interesting to me to see what appears to be a compliant approach. And the issue that was interesting to me was that you can tell the method of payment by the contributor. At least the committee can find that out. And ultimately, it is a committee to make sure that compliance occurs, and so that there's no aggregation over an X amount, then so that they have to report it. And I feel like I'm really concerned about the issue of of not being able to do that if they want to. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if what could be done to give a committee the ability to do this, assuming they want to. And I recognize your response has typically been it's not likely to happen, but it can happen, and a committee may want to actually track things down if, you know, there's huge amounts of money coming in these days by the Internet, not necessarily this way.
Right.
And the committee may want to just make sure that when audit time comes, they've got a way to actually be able to prove they're in compliance.
Well, Commissioner, I think that the committees, as you correctly point out, have a responsibility to keep track of their donors. But above that responsibility, I think they're going to be very highly motivated to keep track of the people who contribute to them. They're going to take the mobile numbers and hopefully continue to communicate with them repeatedly through the election cycle or beyond to continue to gather information from them and donations.
So your thought is, and when they get the list, do they get the amount that was given? Do they get the amount? They get the telephone number, and that's basically what the committee would have to go on?
And the dates.
And the what?
And the dates.
The dates. So your thought is that there's a methodology in terms of an automatic enticement to contact them for more.
Oh, absolutely. And they'll have the data to be able to do that.
Well, they can make a telephone call, but that would be it, right?
Or another text.
Or a text.
You can text back. I guess you can text back. Thanks.
My understanding is that the FEC takes right now contributions through prepaid credit cards, and I was just speaking with some of the auditors right before the meeting on this issue. My understanding, and I don't know if you want to add anything to this, Mr. Hintermister, but is that when people buy a prepaid credit card, you know, at CVS, and they want to donate with that money, with that credit card, which is already prepaid. Actually, why don't you explain it, if you don't mind?
You've got another counsel with you.
It's an analogous situation, I believe, to the concern that Commissioner Walther is raising, which is how do you know who the contributions are coming from? And I think with prepaid credit cards, you don't really know either. And my understanding is we accept payment in that manner as well.
That's true. In the 2008 cycle, in certain cases, we came across, we thought through press reports that gift cards were being used, but in the data that we received, we were unable to distinguish between a credit card, debit card, or whether it was a gift card.
Madam Vice Chair.
So when you say you were unable to distinguish, that means you had the name and address. You couldn't tell that it was from one kind of credit card or a debit card or a prepaid card?
We have the number that is used, and these are through the web usually, but there was no way to associate the credit card to the type of payment to the card used, whether it was a debit card, credit card.
So how are these disclosed?
Oftentimes, I'm sure they were unitemized. I don't know if they were, you know, in the itemized realm over the $200. But committees typically have a database where they do enter all the information that is coming in off of the web,
right.
And that automatically aggregates, compiles their database.
Now, shifting back to the other gentleman at the table. Yes, you. We've got an interesting collection at the table there. Two requesters and then our chief auditor sharing the table. I say for those who might be listening in and aren't don't have the treat of sitting in the room with us. So it's your understanding because I'm not an FCC expert, it's your understanding that committees would be legally able to contact those phone numbers, either by text or by phone, once they received the information that they had gotten a donation via text message from a particular phone number?
That's true, but also there are going to be various industry standards and standards, possibly with communications law, that it's going to regulate the ability to initiate new texts back to someone who has texted a donation. I think we're all kind of familiar with those particular rules and having to make sure that you want to receive those additional texts. But the ability and the desire mm-hmm. are quite there.
But one could at least, the political committees could at least make one contact asking, right?
Yes.
There would be no legal bar to that, right?
Right.
Can I keep talking? Somebody else have questions?
I think you're good.
Okay.
On the web, with the credit card situation, isn't the data fully available in some way or another, the full name of the... I don't know exactly how it works. Maybe on the audit you can tell me. But in the past, if you're working with a credit card, isn't it possible for the campaign to actually know who's making that contribution? Don't they have the information that I'm really talking about, name, maybe address, maybe zip
right.
code number?
I think the bulk kind of credit card contributions that are received by a committee run through a website, and it's kind
full
of seamless,
of information.
Seamless right to their
right.
Data, right to the committee's database, which you know that information would be captured, the
right.
name, address.
So I mean, to me, the huge amount of small donations that we hear about that don't have to be reported, certainly, it seems to me for the most part, the information is available whether it's reported or not through the credit card processing. Am I correct on that?
You want to can you please repeat?
Well, you've seen the numbers of the very high contributions that have been made in less than $50 or less than $200 that has been raised recently.
Right.
I think and in those cases, by credit card, and I assume even by debit card, maybe more so, that at least the committee can find out the name and the amount and the date and maybe some additional information such as a zip code number or whatever. Goes
yeah.
in there, so
yeah, certainly. I think that generally campaigns, it's very systematic that it all flows through, and there's a software program that would aggregate contributions for FEC purposes, for limits purposes as well as itemization. So,
is there a way that under this program the aggregator could provide an aggregation memo that shows this particular telephone number has now contributed X number of dollars? We want you to be aware of that. And maybe wait until you hear back before you push on more than, say, $200 or X amount, whatever X amount is. Is there a way that that could be implemented?
Providing a memo entry on the FEC reports?
The report that goes from the aggregator to the committee.
The reports that will go from the aggregator to the committee will always be able to include the mobile numbers from which the text originated.
Right, I understand.
And the amount of money of that text and the date that that text occurred.
Right.
And there will be, if that mobile number makes an additional text, I'm sure that an aggregator would be able to aggregate that particular phone number and any subsequent texts that are made.
I'm wondering, as part of the service that you would provide, is it possible to do that? So that when you give a report and it's the sixth or seventh month into the cycle,
mm-hmm.
We find that there's this particular number is now given $500, $50 a month, and it's now $500.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way that your computer could have an alarm system that says once it reaches X amount, we notify the committee that there's potentially an excess payment being made that's not being reported?
Should be doing that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Should be doing that.
I don't want to speculate on the exact way to answer your question, but it does sound as though I could talk to the aggregator if you'd like and get an exact sentence back to you.
For me, it would be very positive factor, because it really then would give the committee the opportunity early on to take a look at this. I see sometimes if they get 10,000 telephone numbers coming through, let's say a lot, and then over a couple of months, I mean, that's one hectic system unless somehow they can key into those systems by their computer and start matching numbers computer-wise. But if the aggregator can provide that, that seems to me it would be a great service and would alleviate some of the concerns about enforceability that I think exist under this this business model.
What I was raising earlier is not so much the sort of standard credit card issue, which, you know, I think it's fairly straightforward that campaigns can track who's contributing via a standard credit card. I was talking about the prepaid credit cards that you buy at CVS, and my understanding is that if I went in there and bought 10 of them and contributed each day to a campaign, I could, in theory, enter in a different name for each and every contribution. And my understanding is that the campaign has no way of contacting me to find out, you know, how many times have I given and how much have I given, and am I, in fact, Donald Duck? And I don't know that there's any more security, is what I'm trying to say, in the gift card context. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of comments about that. One is, as one of your colleagues said last time we discussed this, and I actually think this is a persuasive comment, we can't set up our rules in such a way as to absolutely preclude people from violating the law. Violations of the law will occur. That's not necessarily a reason for us not to go forward. I mean, yes, somebody could intentionally report the wrong name. That's, you know, and the committee might not have any way of knowing that. That's why, if that happened, we would probably deem that to be a violation by the donor, but not by the recipient. They have no way of knowing. But what I'm hearing from these requesters, and that's, by the way, why I'm not overly concerned about, for example, the possibility of corporations reimbursing people for their text messages. They could reimburse people for credit card contributions. They could reimburse people for any kind of contributions. It would all be illegal. It would be illegal if they reimbursed these contributions. It would be illegal if they reimbursed those contributions. If we were to say text contributions are okay, we're not giving them a – we're not saying, and I don't think anybody is saying, that there's no way to do it illegally. We're just saying that there is a way to do it legally. But what I think I'm hearing the requester say is that they can provide certain information, unlike the prepaid debit card, where the committee might not actually have any means of getting in touch with the person who originally bought the debit card. They wouldn't have that information. Here they're going to have a phone number. They will have that. They will have a means of figuring this out. And as Mr. Hintmeister said, committees routinely do track this information. They care about who's given the money. They're motivated to know how much money they're getting. I don't think it's all that different for them to take this kind of information that's associated with a phone number and figure out when they've gotten to $200, if it ever gets to that point. Because I think you've put in place a lot of good protections in terms of, you know, having the $50 cap per phone. To bust the contribution limit with $50 a month contributions, even on a multiple phone plan, would take some effort. You know, if you have two phones, one person paying for two phones, and each phone is texting $50 a month, every month for 2 years, you're still not going to bust one person's contribution limit. You'd have to get at least three phones involved if you're doing this on a monthly basis for a 2 year period. So it doesn't seem to me like the risk of that happening. I mean, it really wouldn't be worthwhile for anybody to do it. There are far easier ways to give money to political causes without going through three different cell phone numbers, and it doesn't seem like a realistic risk to me. So I'm not worried about people using this to bust the contribution limits. And I think you have provided us some really helpful information on foreign, the way foreign phone company numbers would be blocked and wouldn't be able to participate. That has given me a great deal of comfort that this wouldn't, on its face, present massive opportunities for foreign contributions to leak into the system. Is it possible that some individual who shouldn't be giving could come to the United States and get a cell phone and text a contribution? Yes, that's possible. Again, it doesn't seem like a huge risk that would be enough for me to want to block what would otherwise be, as all pretty much all of our commenters have suggested in this case, a very beneficial system, one that would be very helpful to the entire system of campaign finance. It would have a small d democratizing effect, bring in a lot of small contributions, and possibly really expand the donor pool out there. I know as recently as 2000, I think Spence Overton did some research on donor demographics and found out that the donor pool was overwhelmingly white, male, old, and upper income, which is, you know, perhaps not terribly surprising. In the 2004 election, a lot more women got involved in donating, I think, due to the presence of dynamic women candidates like Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin. But, you know, the donor pool is probably still not as diverse as the country is, and I think that this would provide a good mechanism for expanding that pool, and that would be a good thing. You know, small donors, donors giving through channels where there aren't a lot of face-to-face interactions, the possibilities of corruption are really, really reduced. You know, it's hard to see how somebody texting a contribution can lead to some form of texting a $50 contribution or even repeated $50 contributions is going to lead to massive corruption in the system. It just seems like a very good idea for a lot of reasons, and one that I have really been working hard to try and find a way to support under our current laws and rules. I don't know whether you all saw the same article I saw over the weekend in the New York Times. The heads of the Maryland and California election commissions were saying, hey, we've got regs that allow text contributions. Of course, their regs, I went and looked, it's not clear that your program would comply with their regs. Their regs do require fairly stringent collection of information on the donors, I think down even to the $10 and $25 donor level. So they have far more stringent requirements on the collection of the information. Now, I do agree with you that the committees will be strongly motivated to try and reach out and find out who is out there giving them money so that they can ask them for more money and so they can try and involve them in other aspects of the campaign. My one concern with the draft C is that it seems to me that it suggests that even if they know who these people are, then they might not have any obligation to report their names if the donations come in $50 increments. And I think if they have the information, which you have said you're going to provide, that a particular phone number has been the source of $200 or more, then I think they are under an obligation under our statute and under our regs to at least make best efforts, to at least make some efforts to try and, you know, putting aside their self-interest, I think the law requires them to make some efforts to try and figure out who those people are so that they could report the names of people who are providing them with more than $200. And I think it's not a hypothetical concern that people might give more than once. One of the old AOs that's cited in Draft C, the Republican Roundup AO from, 1980, I think, talked about how they were going to organize a bunch of small donor events, and they didn't anticipate that any one person would ever show up at more than one of these events. I think we can't quite say that in this instance, that we don't anticipate that anybody would give more than once. In fact, I think, as you have stated, the committees would want them to give more than once. And I think we have some data if we look at what happened with Internet fundraising. over the last few years. I mean, it's hard to remember, but, you know, internet fundraising is actually a pretty recent phenomenon. Now it's kind of taken over the world. But in the 2008 election, Michael Melvin at the Campaign Finance Institute did a lot of analysis of how President Obama, then candidate Obama, raised so much money over the internet and sort of broke down the different categories. And he found that there was a very high, as he put it, an unusually high proportion of donors who gave under $201 contributions more than once and whose aggregates ended up between $201 and $999, that is, in the disclosable category. According to, and I'm quoting from a report from CFI, according to CFI's review of the records, approximately 224,000 of the 405,000 disclosed donors were people who started off by giving at least one contribution of $200 or less and then gave again, usually over the internet, to cross the $200 mark. Usually, they stayed below $1,000. These repeat donors gave the candidate over $100 million. $100 million that he raised in contributions that initially started out below the disclosure threshold, but ultimately crossed the disclosure threshold and were disclosed. And, you know, I've looked at, I certainly haven't looked at every page of the report. Maybe Mr. Hintermeister or his staff have, but still working on it. But I've looked at a number of the pages, and there are many pages on his report, as there are on many candidate reports, that disclose $25 contributions, $35 contributions. I didn't do the math to figure out how many of those were disclosed because they ultimately added up to over $200 and how many of them they just disclosed because they were disclosing everybody. But it is potentially a huge market out there, a huge amount of money that can be raised. And I think certainly for national candidates, I can well understand why both the Romney and the Obama campaign are very interested in this. I think the potential for them to raise a lot of money this way is really there. So for me, the only sticking point here, and I'm hoping to be able, I know we've got still a couple more days before our deadline runs. I know you were hoping we were going to give you the answer today, but I would like to try to work with my colleagues to see if there's some way that we can come up with some language that everyone can live with that would not suggest that the committees have no obligation if they know they've got over $200 coming in from a particular phone number. I think the current draft suggests they would have no obligation to report that information if it initially came in $50 increments. I probably would not be comfortable with that, but I'm and ultimately that's not even your problem. It's the committees that are under the obligation to do the record keeping and the reporting. But I do think that they have some obligation when they know they're getting $200 or more from a single source under our statute to try and figure out who that source is and to report it. And I'm hoping that we can come up with some kind of language that maybe we could all live with. Some might be a little bit fuzzy. We'll see what we can do. I haven't had a chance to share any actual language with my colleagues before the meeting today, and I certainly wouldn't ask them to jump to a conclusion just sitting here at the table. But that's kind of where I am. If we can solve that one issue, I'm there. Because, I really think it's a great idea, and it's going to have a hugely beneficial impact. And, you know, in response to the we had a couple of commenters who said, don't wed yourself to any one technology. I don't think we should. I think there are probably a number of different alternatives that will develop and by different vendors, and that committees ought to be able to take advantage of different kinds of platforms to do this, to raise their funds, as long as they can somehow have an opportunity to gather the information on the donations that aggregate above the disclosure threshold.
Thank you. Commissioner McGann?
So we're still not at yes.
Getting closer.
Close enough for, we can't say that here.
That's right.
I hear the concern you raised. The concern I want to articulate here is I'm not sure how you do it in an AO to this requester. The requester is providing a service to the campaign, providing, you know, we'll call it a fundraising service, broadly defined. And whether the campaign thinks they're anonymous contributions or not. I mean, maybe we can address that. Maybe the issue is a phone number enough to make it not anonymous, and therefore maybe the campaigns do have an obligation to keep track, or is this really a pass the hat where a phone number is not enough? I don't know. I was thinking this was an anonymous sort of deal. But I'm not sure how an AO to this requester can bind a campaign to say, oh, and campaigns have to comply with already existing law and hold up this requester. If campaigns don't do it, that doesn't mean this requester doesn't have the benefit of the AO protection. Mm-hmm. So trying to tie up the campaigns in this, I'm not sure this is the appropriate vehicle to do that. Certainly, the discussion at the table, I think there's, we all agree that if campaigns get contributions, they have to follow current law. And my sense is that you're not really saying anything more than that. But I'm not sure we can say that in this AO. Maybe we can't. I'm not saying no. But like you, at least on the point you've raised, I'm not saying yes today. I was hoping we can get a yes for these requesters, but we're still not there. But hope springs eternal, I suppose. Could I ask one question since you're here, Mr. Engel? Mm-hmm. Putting something in an AO that seems to address what the campaigns must report, does that pose a problem for you folks? I mean, I guess as a factual matter, maybe not, but legally, I'm concerned that we're reaching out in an AO for your client to put something on someone who's not your client, and I'm looking at the protection the AO gives. The point I made, I just want to see if you have any thoughts or reaction to the concept that,
right.
Well, even if it's in the AO, whatever the vice chair wants to put in, let's assume we say fine, and it has something to do with the campaign has to do something. Let's say a campaign, one of your customers doesn't do it. Are you not protected by the AO? That doesn't make any sense.
The aggregator is, of course, the requester here, and none of the other people who came in to help the aggregator with this request are, I believe, part of any specific transaction here. I believe there's even a footnote in the advisory opinion that makes it particularly clear that any of the political consulting firms that are here to work with the aggregator are not part of the answer to this request. So you're correct that the aggregator is the requester. And I think in our interactions with the commission and the follow-up questions, we've made pretty clear that there is a limited amount, although a great amount, of information that the aggregator is going to be able to get from the carriers. One of the things that they will not be able to get from the carriers, because the carriers are not in a position to provide this, are the names and addresses of people who match up with any particular cellular number. What the aggregators are doing in their ordinary course of business is providing information, mobile numbers, and in this particular case, also contributions to the recipient political committees. I think it's correct that the recipient political committees have their own unique issues that they are going to have to confront. And in a series of advisory opinions that you can see throughout the history of this commission, you have allowances such as with the 900 number advisory opinions, or with going back to 1979 with the Fauntroy advisory opinion, where there were, you know, clear things that the political committee was required to do, and in the 900 opinions, clear things that the corporations were required to do. Each particular requester has standing here and is interested in those particular statutes that it must comply with. And I think that if there is a later day when a political committee may wish to come forward and ask whether or not its record keeping or reporting is correct, I think that would be for that political committee to ask. And I believe that, you know, the separation of the responsibilities here between the aggregator and the political committees are such, and the fact that there is no political committee that is, you know, a requester here, means to me that what our client would want is instruction that its ordinary course of business is in compliance with election law, and that if a political committee wants to know what it should do in its ordinary course of business, then I would suggest that that committee come promptly to the commission.
Cindy.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to respond because it's directly on point to what the requester just said and to what my colleague just said, because I don't necessarily disagree with either one of them. It may be a question of taking some language out that I think may suggest that the committees are home free under this advisory opinion. You know, we might have varying views on whether they should be or shouldn't be, but I think there is a way to get to yes here. Because I agree with you that the obligation is on the committee and that I think we can give an answer to these requesters that does not prejudge that issue with respect to the committees.
Mr. Bowerly?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to respond as well because the obligation is on the committees, but the challenge I think we have had, and I want to thank you for your follow-up information, because that's been very helpful to understanding the facts of your request, because the facts of your request, I believe, tell us that committees will be getting the information that they need. My concern at the outset of this request, and some of the questions we talked about last 2 weeks ago, were aimed at finding out whether committees would be able to meet their obligations, because it's very difficult for me to say to a vendor to say, well, sure, that is a perfectly good solution, when I know, if I know, that the committees will never be able to meet their obligations in that scenario. So I think that's this exchange of information and understanding more fully what your request is about has been helpful to that. And I fully agree with the commenters who've come in and argued that small-dollar donations, diversifying the way that people can make contributions, is a very good thing. I will be the last to say that I'm adept at all of the things and using. I did notice that the disclaimers would perhaps be for the first time in sort of the text language. You are is, you know, now I fear that the entire world will no longer be able to spell because of texting. That is my one concern with this, for this idea of diversifying our donations to this realm. What I did find interesting, that all of these commenters who came in and said this was a really great thing, none of them talked about this obligation of committees to be able to continue with their disclosure obligations. But the Maryland and California proposals do, the regulations they've put in place do talk about that, Maryland very explicitly in terms of what the information that must be transmitted. As I agree with Commissioner Weintraub that it's not clear to me that this particular proposal would necessarily meet those state both of those state requirements. It's not a question for us, but I do note that they do have some additional information sharing requirements and some specific requirements about how that transaction goes from the user's account to the committee's account. It's appears to be a very direct transfer of the money.
Commissioner, on that point, I've read the regulations in Maryland and California, and those regulations exist, but it's not clear that they can be complied with, because currently no political contributions are running through Maryland or contributions through California. There are no short codes that are available, so those regulations have not been tested to see whether or not they can even be complied with.
That was sort of my point, if I could just finish.
I'm sorry.
I agree with you. We haven't seen this taken advantage of yet. I don't think that means that we should ignore the disclosure requirements in our law. I appreciate that, you know, two other entities who do what we do similarly have made this effort, but obviously people aren't taking advantage of it, and that means that either it's impossible for the carriers or aggregators or anyone else to really comply with it, which seems to me makes them not as useful as they'd like to be. We'd like to get there. That's, I think, what Commissioner Weintraub is saying, and I share that view. But what I can't do along the way is obviate otherwise required disclosure. I don't think that there is a risk here of circumventing the contribution limits, because frankly, if you were interested in providing a huge amount of money in support of a candidate, you'd probably just start a super PAC. You wouldn't bother buying a bunch of cell phones, right? But there is, I think, a concern about circumventing the disclosure requirements. And so I really do appreciate the information that you've provided us over the last 2 weeks. That is very helpful. I hear Commissioner Walther's concern about prepaid phones. I don't know. It's interesting to me that they have a different kind of – they're identifiable to the industry. So I don't know whether that would be an answer that we could get in terms of understanding how they fit into this system or not. But I think that my concern is still about ensuring that disclosure happens. You've told us that carrier that committees will get it. I absolutely agree. They have a complete incentive to find out who people are, to either get further contributions from them or to sign them up to volunteer or all the myriad ways that campaigns try to engage their supporters. So I think that this that incentive certainly exists. And I think from what you've told us is not only does the incentive exist, but the actual practicalities of how they would go about it are available to those committees. And I appreciate the clarification on the FCC point that Commissioner Weintraub discussed earlier, because I think 2 weeks ago we weren't quite sure whether they would were permitted to reach out even once to that phone number. So while they may not be able to sort of spam text someone, at least they can seek that opt-in and have that opportunity to get the information. So I would look forward to working with my colleagues to see if we could craft some language that makes clear that nothing about this is disrupting any of the committee's obligations with respect to disclosure.
Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a question. I suppose, and let's look at it from the committee perspective, because I share the same views as how do we not create a system that makes it impossible or very difficult for a committee to actually do whatever they want to do to provide disclosure. But if they find in a couple of months' reports that there's the same telephone number is starting to give money, mm-hmm. and it makes them concerned about it, they call them up, can't reach them, but nevertheless, they don't return the call or they text them, it goes nowhere. Can they tell the aggregator to stop, do not accept money on this telephone call anymore?
Yeah.
In an analogous situation, I'm aware of the fact that some telephone numbers can be blocked from texting, especially if there is a high frequency of texting by that number that may alert someone that this phone is being overused for texting. It's also possible that the failure to collect rate from any particular number may make it not worth the while, let's say, of the carrier or the aggregator to keep trying to process contributions or information from a particular texter when they default on making the payment.
Well, I think it's not so much the non-pay, it's the pay. And if you're seeing this money coming in from the same telephone number, our assumption is that it's going to be typically now from the same person, even though family plans aside. Mm-hmm. It might make a campaign kind of nervous if they can't stop that, and yet they're getting a check every month from the aggregator that keeps building this thing up, and they can't stop it.
I think that what I was trying to get
money, or what can they do?
What I was trying to get at is, you know, the ability to block. And I've seen situations where there is the ability to block when there has been overuse, possibly, of a phone for texting, or the ability to block when there has been too high of a failure rate to collect from someone. So that is a situation of blocking that I am aware of.
Would the aggregator be in a position to implement that in this particular case, where it may not be an issue for other types of customers, but when you have a customer that can only accept so much money in a certain way or wants to only connect so much in a certain way, that service can be made available and say, because from a committee's treasurer's perspective, they're going to get nervous if they can't figure out what's really going on in a given time. That's just been, you know, one of my concerns is how to let them do whatever they need to do to comply.
Right. Well, we could work with the aggregator in the next day or two to make sure that that plus any language that you might want to add or might possibly subtract from the draft can be worked in.
Well, I think, as you sense, most all of us, I think, want to try and figure out a way to make it work. Absent what we probably ought to really be doing is trying to do it by regulation and hearing from everybody and having hearings and watching drafts. But given the way we crank out regulations here, that's not likely to happen in the near future. So if we can make it work, I think we should, you know, give it all the chance we can.
Madam Vice Chair?
I agree with that, although the electronic contributions rulemaking that's on our rulemaking priorities list does have a line in there about text messaging, and I think it would be a fascinating subject to explore in a rulemaking, but we shouldn't hold you guys up in the meantime. But I think we would learn a lot more in that context and probably get folks from other vendors who'd want to come in and share their insights with us, and that would be useful.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to start by saying that I was prepared to support Draft C because I think that the proposal that's been set forward by the requester does comply with the law. And for that reason, I do share Commissioner McGann's concern that I hope we can get to yes and not get sidetracked by determining what the legal obligations of, you know, entities that are not parties to this request, what those are. But I am encouraged by what the Vice Chair said, that maybe what we're going to be able to do is subtract some language so that we can not get kind of mired in side issues and allow that to prevent us from giving a yes. But I'm certainly willing to work with my colleagues to figure out a way to make that happen. But I think the most important thing is that we do get to a yes, because I do think that this proposal clearly complies with the Act.
Commissioner McGann.
Said it last time. I was at yes from the start, and I figured I'd say that because some people may be listening and not realize this is the second time around, and I think it's important to stay where everyone is. Just another point on also want to agree with Commissioner Peterson's statement that removing language tends to be a lot easier than crafting new language. And the concern I have if we start adding language and adding things to this request is I've seen this before, where AOs start out on one set of facts and then the commission adds to get votes other things. You know, you already have on the belt and the suspenders, so the pants are fine. But my concern is the desire to add safety pins, duct tape, Velcro, and everything else to maximize the possibility that nothing bad happens. That's not the facts of the request. And as long as we're dealing with the facts of the request, I think we can get, hopefully, what I hear is we can get to a yes. But this has happened before. Take, for example, the Canner AO on federal office holders being able to deal with state parties. Soliciting money going to events. Series of votes went 3-3, and then finally the commission came up with a draft that said if you do the following, you're fine, sort of a safe harbor approach. Even though there was a statement by three commissioners that said you didn't need any of that stuff, the safe harbor became essentially the rule. If you weren't in the safe harbor, you were now on the bottom of you hit the jetty, you were going to sink. So sometimes these belt and suspenders end up becoming affirmative obligations. Second example is there was the request regarding what you had to put on your response device for a taxpayer-funded campaign. It was the AO had a long list. Remember that one? Mr. Engel's nodding. And then that sort of became the lawyers started saying, well, that's now the rule, and everybody had to do that. Well, that was never the rule. A subsequent request came in within the past year or so. Somebody said, that's not really required. Well, no, it's not required for every campaign. But sometimes these AOs take on lives of their own, and they become their own sort of rules. So what I'm saying is I very much appreciate you willing to work with the commission, but to me the AO is presented as is on certain facts, and that should be decided on its facts, because I think the answer is yes on the facts. And just not to risk upsetting a potential yes, a lot of what you've done for me isn't actually necessary. It's not an affirmative obligation going forward in case anyone listens back and wonders where everyone is. You know, maybe you need a belt, but you don't need both belt and suspenders. But other commissioners need more, and that's just the way it goes, and that's fine. It's just because you have a certain set of facts doesn't mean everybody has that same set of facts, which brings me to my final point, which is with technology, it evolves. And I would hate to see this locked in. What I hear from my colleagues is that's not what anyone wants to do, which is really, really good news. You know, the exchange in the last meeting over whether or not your language, the attestations, I guess we called it, whether it matches the previous AO on the issue, and you sort of went back and you matched the DSCC AO. That doesn't really have to. As long as the concept's there, I'm fine, right? And to me, the concept's there that should result in a yes. But I just wanted to put on the record that regardless of where this comes out, if the next person comes in with a better idea, it doesn't mean they have to run through the same door and jump through the hoops you've jumped through to make your model work. So I just throw that out because I've seen this before where things become obligations down the road. And you know, some commissioners think maybe some commissioners think they are. That's fine. But I don't necessarily think that.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with that. And if you want to add language that says, you know, this isn't the only way to do it, that certainly wouldn't be a deal breaker for me. And in fact, I think we want to encourage other folks to be experimenting with other ways of complying with the law and providing avenues for raising funds. I think what happens, I probably wouldn't describe it exactly the same way my colleague does, is that, you know, people come in because they want security. They want the shield. That's why they ask for an advisory opinion. They want to be told, if I do this, I'm going to be safe. And then other people say, well, I don't know about anything else, but I do know that if I do that, I'll be safe. So then everybody starts doing the same thing. And that's not surprising.
True. It does. I mean, I remember, though, that Senator McCain had an issue where he didn't quite squarely come within the Cantor AO, but yet then that was deemed to be an issue. And maybe it was an issue on its own, or if because he didn't come within the AO. That one is a particularly one that stands out. But second, this is quite a day. I made the quip last time that we witnessed the magic and probably the last time it would happen. Here we are again where Obama and Romney still agree on this. There's been no more comments. And not only that, you and I agree on it, almost, but we're not really agreeing here publicly to agree. We're going to not.
I think before this matter is done that you and I will agree.
Without deliberating, because that would take an open meeting.
That's true.
Not sure how we're going to do this one, but, you know, we'll try.
I, too, am in support of Draft C and was prepared to vote for it today, but willing to work with my colleagues to see if we can come up with four votes, or maybe five or six. Just a couple of technical points. The deadline that we have, Mr. Engel, for this AO is June 10th, which is Sunday, so we read it to be the following day, if that squares with you.
That's fine.
Okay. There is a chance, I just tried to confer during the meeting with the Vice Chair, I suppose that there is a chance that we might be able to come up with something even today, in which case we could discuss it, sort of take a recess and discuss it at the end of the meeting, or we may do this on tally either Friday or Monday.
Right.
But obviously we'll keep you in the loop and tell you how things are going. One other matter I just want to clear up is, does anybody have any outstanding questions for Mr. Engel? My impression is that he's good to go, and he's answered a lot of questions and been very patient. And the line of comments that you've been able to bring in is very impressive.
Thank you.
Nice PR job. and so, do you still have a question?
Just one more question.
But we might not need your vote, so. No, I'm just kidding. I was only teasing.
Catch your check-ins, you might.
Yeah, you can ask.
Oh, okay. Just you were going to provide us with some information about what an aggravator may or may not be able to do based on our conversation. That's all I was asking for. And,
okay, so there is one outstanding question.
Right, and what we can do is work with the aggregator in your general counsel's office probably in the next few hours.
Oh, great.
To make sure that there is a very articulate answer to your question. And to the extent that might need to be included in your draft, happy to work with you on that. Also, if you're adding or subtracting footnotes, we're available.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
And all of your answers have been very articulate.
One more comment. I did want to say thank you for the diligent way you got back to us, the good faith way, bringing in some experts to help you answer those questions in a way that we felt had the comfort of some outside expertise. I thought that was persuasive.
I appreciate that. Mm-hmm.